And then he proceeded to lay on them how it is, with four truths. Truth number one, all life is suffering. That's a hard one. What does that mean? Birth involves suffering, death involves suffering, sickness involves suffering, old age involves suffering. Not getting what you want involves suffering. Getting what you don't want involves suffering. And he says, even getting what you want involves suffering because it's in time and it's going to pass away. Say you want to be the playmate of the month, you become the playmate of the month, and next month you're not the playmate of the month anymore. Lay not up treasures where moth and rust doth corrupt, was Christ's way of saying it. Problem is, if it's in time, you're going to lose it. So even getting what you want has an element. It's like riding a wave on surfing. The wave's going to end, even in endless summer. His second noble truth was the cause of suffering is craving or desire. If you didn't crave life, you wouldn't fear death. You wouldn't suffer. If you don't crave something, you can't suffer about it. The third noble truth is, if you give up craving, you end suffering. And the fourth noble truth is the eightfold path, or the means of giving up craving. Giving up craving, giving up desire. And now my teacher, who was a Hindu, is saying to me, desire is a trap, desirelessness is liberation. Desirelessness is liberation. What does all that mean? What it means is extricating oneself from attachment. It means, quote, renunciation. And what does renunciation mean? To us Westerners, it means a guy like Milarepa sitting in a cave where he's been eating green nettles and he's covered with nettle fur and he looks like a bag of bones and you've got to give up everything. Well, it has nothing necessarily to do with that at all. Because what is required on this trip is renunciation of attachment. Renunciation of attachment. Dropping out, not in the external sense, but in the internal sense. It doesn't matter what the external trip is. Any one of them will do. It's the internal process that changes. Now, how do you do that, and what is that about? And how can I tell you how Maharaji reads my mind? Take this meditation. Remember I read you that thing about the 17-year-old Ramana Maharshi. Ramana Maharshi does Gyan Yoga, the yoga of the mind beating out the mind. It's like Zen. And he says, do the following. And he says, just do it relentlessly. Sit down and follow the method of Vichara Atma, the method of self-inquiry. Sit down, you say, who am I? And then you say, I, until you have I placed in the middle of your head, and you can hear it in there, in the middle of your head, I. I'll just take you quickly through it. We won't do it at this moment. You say, I am not this body. And then you experience your torso as object, and I as subject, I in the middle of your head. Then you say, I am not my five organs of motion. Then you experience your arms as object, your tongue as object, your legs as object, your anal sphincter as object, your genitals as object. With the eye in the middle of the head as subject. You note them all. You note your arm doing its thing. You note it. Then you say, I am not my five senses. Now, you've all been in the situation where you're in a room where a clock is ticking, and you start to read something, and you get so involved in what you're reading, you don't hear the clock tick. And then you finish reading, and suddenly the clock is ticking again. Well, that's an involuntary example. You see, the clock continued to tick, your ear continued to hear the clock tick, but you were no longer attending to your ear hearing the clock tick. So at this point, you don't turn it off. You just note your ear hearing, your eye seeing, your nose smelling, your tongue tasting, your skin feeling. Then you say, I am not my five internal organs, and you go through respiration and breath, and you digestion and excretion and perspiration and circulation. Each of them, you either fantasy it or experience it as object. And then you come to the stinker, the clincher, the powerful one, the key to the whole thing. When you've done all that, and it may take you months to get to that place, then you say, I am not this thought. What thought? The thought of I am not that thought. And you begin to see your thoughts as if you were looking at a ticker tape news thing going by you. I am not this thought. What thought am I not? The thought of I. Here I am. Where's here I am? Here I am is over there. Where am I? Where am I? See? And if you can play this one out, at that point you have gone behind your senses and behind your thinking mind. And you pass through a doorway, and you enter into another state of consciousness. And another state of consciousness is discontinuous with your normal waking state of consciousness. William James, the philosopher, said, our normal consciousness, our normal waking consciousness, is but one special type of consciousness. Whilst all about it, parted from it by the filmiest of screens, there lie other types of consciousness, quite different, each having its own field of application and adaptation. No account of the universe in its totality is complete which fails to take into account these other types of mentality. But how to consider them is the question, for they are so discontinuous with our normal waking state of consciousness. And so on. And you go through a doorway at that point into another state of consciousness. Now, if you are able to do that, where is it you go to? You go into a thing which is called samadhi. That's one name for it. You go into a low level of samadhi, and there are 8 or 9 stages of this. Keep that in mind for a moment, and let me introduce another metaphor to you, a metaphor in the Western framework. Think of a solid object, mass, as a pattern of energy. We know that. We're hip, sophisticated people. We know that. We know that though this seems solid, it is in fact a pattern of slowed down light. Just seems solid to our particular sense receptors. Now imagine if this is a pattern of energy, then light is also a pattern of energy, sound is a pattern of energy, thought is a pattern of energy. And what then is energy? And you get into a finer and finer form of energy because behind that one there's another one, and behind that one there's another one, and behind that one is another one. And you finally get down to the state of energy that is so fine, it is no longer unique. It's no longer unique. That is, if you think of an atom as having electrons and neutrons and so on, protons, even the electron, which has a uniqueness to it, is made up of some of these, a pattern of these finer things. And the quality of these finer things is that they are everywhere. Anything you can label, call it vacuum, call it space, call it ashtray, call it thought, call it emotions, call it Mars, it's all this made up of this same thing. You with me? You got the image? If you are now aware that behind everything there is this very fine energy, and it's all interchangeable, and it's constantly moving in and out of everything, you begin to understand that we are a solid. This is solid. It's all solid. This is made up of that energy. This is made up of that energy. That flame is made up of that energy. Tomorrow is made up of the energy. Yesterday is made up of the energy. And it's all just interchanging, and it's not unique at all. Now the next statement that is worthy of some reflection is that that type of energy, which is the finest form of energy that is in the world of form, or what's called prakriti, or many names, that very fine form of energy is an identity with, not equal to, but an identity with consciousness. Not self-consciousness, but consciousness. That means that when you extricate yourself from the time-space locus of this body, these thoughts, this set of senses, You, what you call me, that I that I experienced when I first took psilocybin, that Ramana Maharshi experienced when he thought he was going to die, that I that has nothing to do with this body, this personality, this whole trip. What is that? That is that energy. And it is known in Sanskrit as Sat-Chit-Ananda. You enter into a state of Sat-Chit-Ananda. And Sat-Chit-Ananda means absolute existence, absolute knowledge, and absolute bliss. Now, that's a big one, and let me just clarify who you really are, because you may want to know just what it means to be God. Take Ananda. That's a groovy one to take. Bliss. You go surfing. You get to just that place on the wave where it's all perfect. You've just got the wave, you're just riding the place in the wave, perfect. Yeah, right, here we are. Wow, oh, is that good. It's that timeless moment, you're right there. You paint a picture and you get to the place where the picture is just coming out itself and it's perfect, it's just the way it's supposed to be. Yeah, right. You're doing a scientific research project and you see a relationship. Oh, wow, yeah. You get a degree and everybody's proud of you. Oh, yeah, you get a moment of that thing again. That feeling, for a quick second, it's all right, yeah. Oh, so good, so good. The method that most Westerners are most familiar with for getting to that little place is, of course, the sexual experience. Because at the moment of orgasm, you transcend, if albeit briefly for most Westerners, you transcend your ego. And it becomes merely an experience in which there happen to be four legs and four arms and two heads and movement. And you are part of an experience. And there is a moment in there when you say, yeah, oh, right, I just like to stay right at this place forever. You all know the place? It's called fulfillment. It's called contentment. It's called a feeling of well-being. It's called it's all right with the universe. It's called, yeah, it's called isness. We got lots of names for it. It's unnameable, right? It's a state. It's a state of being. It has nothing to do with doing. It's a state of being. It's a moment. It's an eternal moment. It's outside of time. That place which you identify with your method of getting there. So if you're a surfer, you say, baby, all I want to do for the rest of my life is surf. And if you're a sexual gymnast, you say, oh, man, all I want to do is make out forever. Or whatever your particular turn-on method is to get you to that place. And when you say, you turn me on, or that scene turns me on, you mean it allows me to touch that place again. But the funny thing is that the place is inside of you. The place is not connected with your method. It's not out there. When you say you fall in love with somebody, it means that they are a stimulus which turns you on to that place. Now you've got to understand that Sat-Chit-Ananda means living in that place all the time. When I try to figure out where Maharaji, what state of consciousness he's in, I begin to understand he's in what's called Sahaja Samadhi. He is living in a state of perpetual, total, ecstatic sexual union with the entire universe at every moment. Is that enough? That's known as Ananda. Chit, which means absolute knowledge. He sits there absolutely mindless. There's not a thought in his head. He's not sitting around thinking, I think I'll lay on him about his mother's spleen. That'll really blow his mind. There's no ego there at all. He's just absolutely sitting there mindless. And out of my needs comes that particular thing. And here's the extraordinary issue of what renunciation or surrender is about, because it's so beautiful. He is sitting there mindless, and out this thing comes. In other words, he has become that kind of energy, so he is my mother's spleen as well as everything else in the universe. It's all interchangeable, it's all interrelated, it is all one. It's known as the clear white light in some systems. It is a complete homogeneous field in which when you're hooked up, you're in it all. You are it all. That's what chit is. But the point is, he doesn't know he knows. Because there's nobody around to know he knows. You hear that? You give up knowing you know to be it all. And the surrender is the surrender of the guy who knows. And the Westerner is not about ready to do that. See? Because he wants to know he knows. And what the Westerner is on is what's known as the asymptotic curve of the subtle sphere. It's a curve that never meets the place, but it sucks you in further and further and further because you almost know you know. See? You get very far out. You see so much. You begin to see. I had a friend, Aldous Huxley, who was in one of these places. And finally, he was down to practically one word. I mean, he had a beautiful command of language, but everything was blowing his mind all the time. And he was going around, and all he'd say was, "Extraordinary." Everything he would look at, anything, "Extraordinary." He was seeing how it all was, and he was gassed by seeing how it all was. But finally, you've got to give that one up too, you see? And the problem, the thing that's so interesting is when you start to go into samadhi, the first thing you go into are these waves of bliss like you've never had before. Oh, God, it's so good. Oh, boy. And why not hang out here, man? This is pretty good. But the Vedas say, keep going, baby, don't stop now. The problem is you've got to give up the experiencer. The experiencer of bliss is still separate from the bliss. And finally, you become the bliss. The knower is separate from the knowledge. Finally, you give up the knower to be the knowledge. The here and now is separate from he who is thinking about or experiencing the here and now. So finally, you give up him. See? Hear that? It is surrender. But the rules of the game say that you can only surrender when there is no surrender. That is, if you think you've given something up, forget it. Forget it, because you can't do it. For example, I am a practicing yogi, and I love root beer. Now, root beer is not listed by the Vedas as one of the foods that yogis eat. And I am a beginner on the trip. I am in the first of many years of training, and I still like root beer. Now, I can sit in my meditation room, and I can look so holy, butter would melt in my mouth. I mean, I really look like Buddha himself, except all the time I'm thinking about root beer. Well, if I'm thinking about it, I might as well drink it. But every time I drink it, I strengthen the whole habit of drinking it. But if I don't drink it, I sit and think about it. See? So sometimes I'm sitting in the meditation room and I'm just sitting and I'm very zonked out. And the next moment I notice I'm at my father's refrigerator holding a bottle of root beer, drinking it. And at first I go through, oh, damn it, you're drinking root beer again. And then I see that putting myself down for drinking the root beer is just another form of attachment too. Ramana Maharshi says, instead of sitting around wailing and saying, alas, I am a sinner, get on with it. If you spend all that energy doing your thing, you'd all be enlightened. So all you can do is develop a place in yourself, which is called the witness, which notes it, which says, there he is drinking root beer. There he is putting himself down for drinking root beer. This is what is known as karma yoga. Because what extricating yourself from desire and attachment doesn't mean, it doesn't mean that you stop having the desires or in some ways fulfilling them. It means you stop being identified with he who is having the desires. If I am not my body, then every time I make the statement, I am sleepy, I am hungry, these are lies. You understand that? Do you understand what is required then? What is required is a complete reorganization of your entire thought process. Because you're thinking from one vantage point, and if you're going to make it, you're going to be thinking from another vantage point. You've got to change your perceptual viewpoint, your cognitive conceptual core, and all those funny words. And yoga is a technique. Yoga means union. It is a technique designed, all the different yogas, and there are many different yogas, are each designed to take you and to work with various aspects of your being to take you to the place where you are in this other vantage point. Because our problem primarily is that our minds are completely out of control. Absolutely out of control. Vivekananda likens our minds to drunken monkeys. I mean, you just think of what's happening to your own thoughts at this moment. You listen to me for a moment, you're aware you're hot, you think about the time, you feel your body, you feel perspiration, you wonder about something, your thought goes off somewhere else, you're aware you're next to a neighbor, you think about later, you remember before, you wonder what use this will be to you. I mean, I can pick up thousands of things, and you know, we're all thinking lots and lots and lots, and they're just going by just like that. And the funny thing that has happened in the West, and now in the world, is that the rational mind, which is the highest tool that man has for gaining enlightenment, is also the most powerful trap, it turns out. And what has happened is our minds, which are in effect servants, have become masters. I mean, if at this moment, a naked girl walked out of that room and walked up here, all your consciousness would be copped. Right? She'd just take all your consciousnesses with you. Maybe one person here would be able to just keep right on with, you know, here we are. Huh? And that too, and here we are. Everybody would go on the trip because you're completely at the whim of your stimulus input. You are your senses. You are your thoughts. And the game is to calm your mind down so that you are no longer your senses and your thoughts. In that way, you are free of them, and then they become the servants they were meant to be, and you can use the exquisite response mechanism that is the brain and thought for what it's supposed to be used for, without it running the ship.